This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
If you or your child is autistic, how hard is it to play team sport, to just find a team to join? We know that sport can create a sense of belonging and a sense of pride. However, new research shows that for many autistic people, it's actually really hard to find a team. The barriers include everything from sensory overload, communication challenges, even social exclusion. 3 out of 4 autistic children wanted to play sport, but just couldn't find a way. So what needs to change? If this has been your experience, or maybe your club is doing something to ensure that whoever wants to join can, 1300 222 774. And also coming up this hour today, there have been a lot of memories shared on the 50-year anniversary of the Whitlam dismissal. But on Friday, Justin Smith was reminiscing with Steve Brax, where, well, he spoke about many things, including attending a spontaneous protest in Ballarat. But he also clearly remembers exactly what he was wearing.
I think I had flares on. You know, Staggers denim flares. I had a full beard. I had my hair was big. You know, because I've got thick hair, it was sort of frizzy almost. You know, with a big hair. So yeah, I look like I should have looked in the 70s.
So that's Steve Brax there. He has a clear memory of exactly what he was wearing in 1975, the day that Whitlam was dismissed. So can you remember? I mean, 1975, right? It's peak flares. Were you disco? Were you glam rock? Were you punk? Were you hippie? Were you wearing clogs, maybe a jumpsuit or tie-dye? Can you remember the outfit you wore on the day that the news broke?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So if either you or your child is autistic, have you been able to find a team sport to play? Have you felt welcomed? Have you been able to join? New research shows that there are a lot of challenges, not just for autistic children, but for autistic adults as well. And those barriers can be anything and everything from sensory overload, maybe some communication challenges, or just some form of social exclusion. But as we're about to learn, this research shows that 3 out of 4 kids want to play sport, but they just couldn't find a way. So what needs to change? Dr. Chris Edwards is from the Aspect Research Centre for Autism Practice. And Chris, you've conducted this research, which was quite alarming, actually, when you look at the high numbers of people who are autistic who want to participate in sport and for whatever reason can't. What prompted this research for you?
Thanks for having me. So, I'm an autistic adult, so I've experienced a lot of the challenges and the benefits of sport and physical activity. So I guess when I was younger, I wanted to join in. I'd, you know, sign up for a team, get excited, but then day came of, you know, tryouts or whatever it was, it just, anxiety would take over, and that's just a big old, nope, not going to do that, no thank you, too much unknown, anxiety, time to avoid.
And so did that stop you from playing and participating in sport altogether as a young person?
Not altogether, but it did stop a lot of those new opportunities or more team sports where, you know, you'd be going through a team tryout or just be a lot of unknowns. At the moment, I've just committed to, I've been playing tennis since school, and I think that's quite easy because it's quite individual at most in terms of team. I've only got one teammate to play with on the court.
So in that time, how long ago was this, Chris? I mean, you're giving away your age here, but you know, how long ago are we talking?
I turned 33 a few days ago. So
happy birthday.
It would have been, thank you. It was back in probably high school is where I remember that.
Well, you're a fellow Scorpio. I think we might even share the exact same birth date. So happy birthday indeed. So what's changed in that time? Has it got any better? Because your research actually shows that around 3 in 4 children who are autistic want to participate but can't. And there's something like 69% of adults who are autistic also want to participate in sport and for whatever reason can't as well. So those numbers are really high.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess just to clarify, a lot of that is it's more wanting to participate more than they are. So it's not that they're completely doing nothing. It's that they want to be involved more than their current level.
So what could change? What would make it more inclusive, do you think? Because I'm sure for a lot of clubs, whether it be basketball or netball or soccer, you name it, maybe they think they're doing enough. And quite often on this show, we talk about don't look at who's in your club, look at who isn't in your club and whether or not it is a truly welcoming space for everyone. What can clubs think about?
Yeah, definitely. And there's, I mean, look, if you've got the money to commit to training or creating resources, that, you know, that's amazing. But understand money is tight everywhere at the moment. There's a lot of small practical things that can be done. Just letting people use sensory supports, like letting kids wear noise-cancelling headphones or wearing a different uniform or just creating a dedicated quiet space so people, if they get overwhelmed by the environment, they have somewhere to go and regulate before coming back.
And how can they even let people know? Because sometimes you don't know until you know, right? And you may not even know why somebody leaves a team. You may not even know if that child or adult is autistic. And you don't have that information. You can't make those changes unless you're well informed. So is there a way that clubs can educate themselves prior to this?
Definitely there is a lot that can be done. Even, I guess, nobody, you don't need to be an expert in autism or hidden disabilities. It's about demonstrating that you you are aware that you can be flexible, because too often there were so many stories of even parents disclosing that their kid is autistic and then the gym coming back and being told, the kid's not the right fit for this team and no longer being welcome there. So there's a lot of reasons why people aren't going to tell you. It's on you as the club or the instructor or the volunteer to demonstrate that you have some level, that you are inclusive. And that comes down to that. There's so many things that can be done, whether it's on the website, you know, showing that you have an understanding of hidden disabilities, or it's in the programs you offer, that there's not a one-size-fits-all approach, that there is some flexibility in what programs people can enroll in or access.
You're listening to Dr. Chris Edwards from the Aspect Research Centre for Autism Practice, who has just conducted some research that's looking at those who identify as autistic, either as a child or as an adult, who want to participate in sport. And really high numbers show that they're not actually participating at levels that they'd hope to. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Our number's 1300 222 774. Chris, I could imagine as well that the onflow impacts of being included in a team sport, not just for the autistic person, but for everyone else in the team, that those benefits are lifelong and would flow into other parts of their life. So work, relationships, you name it, and it would be win-win for everybody.
Definitely. It all comes back to that appreciating differences, whether it's in the team or in society. Differences in groups make things better. You don't want to all be the same person thinking the same way. And by including more autistic people, there's benefits for mental health, physical health, community connections, and it really sets both kids up for success, and it can help re-engage those adults that have given up on sport because of the horrible experiences they had as a kid.
And I guess you need to question too, especially with children, ensuring that your team yes, they're there to learn and to participate, but also it's fun. It's not just all about winning and that you have people at all different skill levels. Just finally, Chris, I mean, can people access this research? People might be a coach or they might be a parent and listening to this right now and think, oh, wow, actually, we need to, you know, maybe take a look at our website, or we need to take a look at our forms that we have that we fill in, or even if it's how our stadium is set up or the lights or whatever it may be. Can people access your research?
Yeah, definitely. So the research has been published for free in a journal called Neurodiversity, but otherwise it should be able to find it on Aspect's website under our research program.
It's really important, Chris, because we know that sport, it's not just about getting out there and kicking the footy or, you know, bouncing a ball. It's actually about social inclusion and it's about community connection, and that's what makes us tick. So it's really important work that you're highlighting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
See ya, Dr. Chris Edwards from the Aspect Research Centre for Autism Practice. Lachlan's in Eltham. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Really well. What did you want to share?
I play disability footy for Eltham, and so we have a feeder team there, which is pretty cool. So yeah.
And tell us about your club. How does it work?
So we train one night a week, and then we play every second Sunday at, against other teams. We play for a competition called Feeder.
And how's this season going for you, Lachlan?
This season we came fifth, so we almost got into finals, but not quite.
Oh, so close, hey? Oh, look, it's not just about finals, but, you know. And why is sport important to you?
For the fitness, for the fun, yeah, and for learning new skills as well.
Good on you, Lachlan. Lovely to hear from you. Thank you. Rosemary's in Blackburn. Good morning, Rosemary.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm really good. What do you want to talk about?
I'm really, really pleased to say that we have an autistic child in an under 11 basketball team, and that we've promoted the fact that the rest of the kids need to look after him. Mm-hmm. And it's going so well.
So it's how do you do that, right? How do you say to the other kids, you've got to look after yep. this young boy,
yep.
but at the same time without making a big song and dance about it and really yep. pointing somebody out? How do you do it with dignity?
We just say simple things like, you can't steal the ball from him, you need to make sure you pass to him, and we even go to the opposition teams and the referees on game day and inform them that he is in fact in this situation, and we'd appreciate them being sympathetic.
Oh, I love that. And what sort of reaction do you get, Rosemary?
Most of the time it's good, because I really, really believe that referees and opposition teams have the right to know that mm-hmm. a kid is in that scenario, because if they don't, the situation can get unreasonably tense. And as we know, sometimes they don't have emotional filters. So it's better that the opposition and the referees know, because as I say to the referees, if he needs to, I'm not going to go through a substitution process. I'm just going to take him off the court.
Yeah.
And they go, yep, that's cool. But the kids have been great and he's getting same court time as everybody else.
I love everything about this, Rosemary. What about the idea, I guess, of as it becomes more serious? So
yep.
you've got players, because you said under 11s, yeah?
Yes.
So once they get to, say, under 14s, under 16s, you've got players who want to maybe try out for rep. They want to win and play finals. Does that alter anything? I would hope not, but I'm just wondering.
No. The thing about it, he will find his own level. And whatever level he's at, it's up to coaches and organisations to optimise his inclusion, make sure that he's in an environment where he can participate to the level that he's able.
And how long has he played in the team?
Oh, just this season, about 6 weeks.
Love it. I love it. And is everyone benefiting from this, do you think, Rosemary? I could talk to you for hours about this.
yeah. No, the kids are so good.
Yeah.
The kids are amazing. The parents don't have a choice. No, their parents have been great too. So, no, it's all working extremely well, and we'll continue with those protocols. And his confidence and his inclusion will improve. Now, I don't know what level that they'll improve to, but as long as he's able to. And I don't know, maybe somewhere down the track we could start promoting competitions for these sort of challenged kids.
I love the idea, though, of not segregating, you know. And
I agree.
Because
it
filters into everyday life. I mean, the non-autistic kids will also be learning how to just treat everybody equal. That will flow into school. Yep. That will flow into workplace. Yep. Rosemary, congratulations. Yep. I think it's really great. Well done.
Thank you. No, and look, I'd love to build a model where other people can get it done.
Yeah, and I think it's just about being open and honest. I remember years and years ago speaking to a mum who would advocate for her son who lives with Tourette's, who loved soccer, right, wanted to play soccer, but was really worried about his tics. He had vocal tics. It also included swearing. And she said, you know what, I'm just going to go to clubs and I'm just going to tell them and we're going to be up front, and then that coach will be up front with the other team. That's what they did. And everyone just went, yeah, okay, cool, no worries. And especially kids, most of the time, they just roll with it. And that's how you create change and inclusion. We've got Brooke in Beveridge. Morning, Brooke.
Hi there.
Well, welcome. What did you want to say?
Yeah, my 18-year-old started off in Little Athletics probably about five or 6 years ago. He's level 3 autistic, so he has doesn't communicate very well. He's quite affected. And athletics, he's long past little laths. The athletics pathways, that's gotten involved into sport at a more professional or semi-professional level. It's changed his life and it's changed our life.
Really? In what way? How has it changed your life, Brooke?
Well, it dominates our lives because he's always at training or competing. We have athletics tourism where we go around to the competitions. He, as far as inclusion is concerned, he just trains at his club, just in, you know, as another kid. And in competition, he competes with everybody else. But then when you get to like representative, that's when it branches off into the disability. Sort of like the para.
Yeah, right. But up until a certain age, it's just all inclusive.
Yeah, well, it's not even so much age. They run side by side. The para competition.
Have you seen it change and filter through? Because what I love that intersection with sport and everyday life and community, because that playing sport isn't just about being great at basketball or aths or whatever. It's actually about having a connection in a community and feeling like you have a sense of belonging. Has that filtered through?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. The coaches were a bit, okay, yep, he can come along, we'll see. But he's an integral part of the club now. And he holds his own. So he's not just like there's the kid that, you know, coming along and having a, you know, good on you trying. He actually holds his own. But the coaches, and also even to Athletics Victoria, props to them. The officials have, it's been a, we've seen a real change there with the officiating. They get a lot out of learning about and supporting the para competition.
And that's what Rosemary said too, is that you just talk to the refs beforehand. And I think everyone is open and you don't know until you know. Brooke, really great to hear your story. Thank you. And there's a lot more like it. We'll try and get back to more of your calls on this a little later in the program. But also today, for a lot of you, have been reminiscing about the 50-year anniversary of the Whitlam dismissal. A little earlier in the week, actually on Friday, Justin Smith was filling in for me here on the Conversation Hour, and he spoke with Steve Brax about the dismissal. And we're going to play some highlights for you on that in just a moment. But one of the things Steve Brax remembers very, very clearly is what he was wearing on the day.
I think I had flares on, Staggers denim flares. I had a full beard. I had my hair was big. you know, because I've got thick hair, it was sort of frizzy almost, you know, it was a big hair. So, yeah, I look like I should have looked in the 70s.
So do you remember, like Steve Brax, exactly what you were wearing on the day of the dismissal? This, I was wearing a school uniform. However, more impressively, my teacher, who wore an academic gown, which was as she strode across the hockey field like a raven about to launch into the sky, she burst into the classroom and told us to go home. She was enraged. It was my political self activated from then on. Another saying, yes, Rish, I remember. It was a pair of overalls. I was working at Ford, where we lived at the time. That's from Alan. And Susan says, easy, I remember. I was in my school uniform. I was in year 11 at the time, back in 1975. So do you remember exactly what you were wearing on the day that the Whitlam government was dismissed? You know, were you disco? Were you hippie? Were you in clogs? Were you in a jumpsuit? Were, like Steve Brax, were you wearing flares?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So in just a moment, I'm going to play you some highlights of an incredible conversation that Justin Smith had with Steve Brax as they reminisced on the dismissal, on the Whitlam government dismissal. So I'm going to play you some of the highlights in just a moment. But he remembered very clearly what he was wearing. If you can remember what you were wearing on the day, 1975, whew, could there be a better date in fashion? If you were in flares, if you were in tie-dye, if you remember exactly what you were wearing, I'd love to hear from you. Roberta's in Mornington. You've got strong memories of the day, Roberta?
I do. I don't remember what I was wearing, but whenever anyone talks about the Whitlam dismissal, I'm instantly taken to the room that I was standing in. I can see it so clearly. And I remember the feelings of standing there as a 13-year-old and hearing the adults being really upset, like crying, and being sort of a little bit, well, I was unsettled by it because I didn't really understand it, but I knew it was bad. And that was sort of my first really big political, thought, I suppose.
Moment, yeah, right. Yeah, and, so what was the room? Can you paint the picture of the room?
Yeah, so we lived in this Besser brick house in North Queensland, and the back garage had been converted into a TV room, and there was a loft. We put in a loft, and the loft was me and my younger sister's bedroom. It was a mattress on the floor, and it had a ladder up to the loft. And I was standing exactly near that ladder with brown lounge chairs with chrome, you know, that were bent chrome with the, mm-hmm. like the 1970s.
Oh, I love that style. Yeah. Yeah. Velour? Were they velour?
Yeah, they were dark brown, like velour.
Yeah, mission brown.
And they were sort of slung and chrome, bent chrome.
Oh, no, you know, I know the brand. Yeah. It's Tessa. They're worth a fortune now.
Yeah, and the Besser brick, white bricks painted, you know, the bricks painted white. And and there were two steps down into the main part of the house, and the adults were there. And I just remember standing there and so clearly, and I still feel the emotion of it.
Yeah.
Because I thought, wow, this must be really big. This must be really bad. This is something really bad.
It's so visceral, isn't it?
And it is.
And given that it's 1975, I mean, for me who loves 70s fashion and 70s furniture, sounds like you're even talking about a sunken lounge that went down and everything about it is perfect.
North Queensland, not too fancy.
Oh, no, well, this is the thing, right, with the 70s. It wasn't fancy, but it was just so great. Roberta, thank you. Well, on Friday, Justin Smith filled in for me. And so in case you missed it, he actually had a really insightful chat with our former Premier, Steve Brax. Now, he reflected clearly on the day, you know, what happened, all of the emotions, and on top of it, you know, he also spoke a little bit about what he was wearing. But Justin started off by asking Steve Brax to take him back to that day.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine now, but politics was everything at that time. Everyone was tuning in, everyone was listening to what was happening. And at that time, the parliamentary proceedings were broadcast on what was then 774. They were broadcast live because parliamentary broadcasts had just started in 75 and as an experiment, and it was ongoing. And I was at home at my parents' house where I lived in Mount Clear, just outside Ballarat, in my bedroom, listening to the parliamentary proceedings, because I thought there would be a half-cent election. I thought Gough Whitlam would call a half-cent election, and we're all waiting for that as a way of breaking the deadlock of what was happening in the upper house. And I heard on the parliamentary proceedings the Speaker, Gordon Scholes, calling on the member for Werriwa. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, member for Werriwa? Why isn't he calling on the Prime Minister?
Yeah.
He gave him the call in the House, and then Whitlam got up and indicated that he had been sacked by the Governor-General. It was just cataclysmic. I could not believe it.
And what did you do? You were angry. What could you do?
So I immediately left home, went to what I thought would be the place that you could go to assemble with others, and that was the Trades Hall Council in Ballarat in Camp Street. So I went to Camp Street and I got there, and there was hundreds of others there, members of the party, supporters of the Whitlam government. They were there as well. And somehow, someone had found a... This is true, by the way. Someone had found a coffin, or come across a coffin.
Yes.
We draped it in black. We wrote the death of democracy across the coffin, and I was, with others, carrying it on the shoulders from the Trades Hall in Ballarat down to the only place we could think of to protest effectively was the Ballarat Courier Office in Sturt Street. So we carried that coffin down and then had roaring speeches on the steps of the Courier Office. And so that was my experience of the dismissal.
That's an extraordinary... Do you remember... You obviously remember the events that happened. Do you remember feeling that anger and that disbelief?
Enormous anger. In fact, death of democracy wasn't just the slogan on the coffin. It was actually what we felt. We felt this was the democratically elected government being sacked by the Queen's representative. It was outrageous, unprecedented, and we never, ever thought this would happen in Australia. And so there was a sense of anger, and immediately we turned to the re-election of the Whitlam government, and immediately went into campaign mode, and enormous campaign rallies were held. You know, we had one in Ballarat addressed by Bob Hawke, who was then the president of the ACTU, the secretary of the ACTU, and it was thousands of thousands of people in the civic hall in Ballarat listening to every word of Bob Hawke in that period. And we thought, you know, there was and numerous people coming out on the streets, and we thought this is going to mean that the Whitlam government would be re-elected, that the injustice that was done by sacking Whitlam would be overturned and he would be re-elected. And how wrong we were, of course. You know, the size of the demonstrations didn't resemble anything like what was going to happen at the ballot box soon after, and the Whitlam government lost significantly, one of the worst losses we've had, actually.
Was that a fuel for somebody like you who went on to then achieve, to win a seat and then become a leader? And was that fuel for you, what had happened?
Oh, totally. Enormous fuel for me. I went on to manage our campaigns in the seat of Ballarat, the federal campaigns, which we eventually won with John Milton. We had a breakthrough after 27 years and won the federal seat. I managed our state campaigns, and Frank Sheehan was a breakthrough there where we won the state seat. And then I went on to stand myself when I was a 29-year-old in the seat of Ballarat North against sitting member Tom Evans, who was more than twice my age. I stood in 85, lost. Then I stood twice in 88 in a by-election when he left. I got a good swing to me, and then the general election a bit after that. So I had three goes at getting into state parliament as a result of what was happening in the dismissal. I was so motivated. I wanted to get in. I wanted to do things. I wanted to make a difference.
What do you think we have learned, you know, 50 years later? Is the vapor trail of what happened still there, and are the lessons still being learned, or have we forgotten too much of it?
I think one thing we should learn is to never take our democracy for granted. It should be cherished. We have a great democracy, you know, compulsory voting, the preferential system, you know, it's one of the best in the world, the secret ballot. Don't take that for granted. It's important that we enshrine it, we keep it, and we celebrate it. And I think that's the big lessons coming out of 75. Look what can happen when you don't take it for granted.
Please take us back, if you don't mind, very quickly. What would a 21-year-old Steve Brax have been wearing? What would he have looked like? Was he a bit scruffy, or was he the tidy kind of type that we came to know?
Very untidy. I think I had flares on, you know, Staggers denim flares. I had a full beard. I had
a beard.
Oh yeah!
Oh wow! Okay.
Oh yeah. I had my hair was big. You know, because I've got thick hair, it was sort of frizzy almost. You know, it was a big hair. So yeah, I look like I should have looked in the '70s.
So that's Justin Smith, who was filling in for me on Friday, speaking with Steve Brax. And I've been asking you, can you, like Steve, remember what you were wearing on the day when you heard the news of the dismissal? Some great outfits. Look, it might have something to do with the fact that mid, you know, 1975 is my sweet spot for fashion. However, Rish, I was in my school uniform, grade 5. The head nun broke the news over the PA. I remember because politics wasn't necessarily taught in our Catholic primary school, but the teachers decided it was a good teaching moment. Our young homeroom teacher dressed in a miniskirt, polo neck jumper and high knee boots. She had tears in her eyes, and I just remember this somber blanket coming down on a usually rowdy classroom. That's from Denise. And this: on the 11th of the 11th, 75, I strode enraged across the grass at the Monash Union building as the speakers bled out the news of the dismissal. I was wearing a long denim skirt, a tie-dyed purple and pink T-shirt, waist-length hair, and no bra. I got to vote for the first time on that following election. That's from Alice in Mitcham. And I'm even being sent some incredible photographs as well of what people were wearing on that day. So if you know, if you have photographs of what you were wearing on the day, if you can remember what you were wearing on the day when you heard about the dismissal, Helen has sent me this incredible image. And Helen, I so want that skirt if you still have it. It's kind of this lovely peachy sort of high-waisted knee-length skirt. According to your text, it was year 11 and you were actually there. You were in Canberra and you were supposed to go on a tour of Parliament. However, it was cancelled for the day. You got a lovely scarf on as well. So if you can remember what you were wearing on the day, 1300 222 774. Alex is in Murrumbina. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
You can remember what you were wearing.
I certainly can. I was wearing a clinical gown and I was in the delivery suite of Bethlehem Hospital giving birth to my son who's 50 today.
Oh my goodness. So you have complete, you would have like very strong memories of what you were wearing.
I do. The nurse came running in saying, oh, Whitlam's been sacked, Whitlam's been sacked. And I said, well, what can I do about it?
Yeah, I'm a little busy here if you haven't noticed.
Yes, yes.
Oh, well, happy birthday to your son, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you remember, 1300 222 774, high-waisted jeans, jumpsuits, maybe a pair of clogs, all very, very good stuff. Lucianne Tonti is a sustainable fashion editor and author. And Lucianne, I actually want to talk to you about the rise of a physical store of Shein in Paris. But before we do, is 1975 like not the best year for fashion, or am I just a little biased?
Well, I'm curious. I mean, it was before I was born, I need to say. But I'm curious, what is it about that era that you love so much?
Oh, the high-waisted jeans, the hair, the flicks. I don't know. It's everything, the denim, women, I think, really took ownership of what they wanted to wear as well.
I think that's what stands out about the 70s to me. It's, you know, the rise of the women's pantsuit, you know, really that kind of tuxedo that Yves Saint Laurent designed, you know, towards the end of the 60s, you know, really kind of a moment for women's empowerment, I guess. And that's what we see, you know, right through the 70s. It was, you know, freedom, liberation, and it's reflected in all of the clothes. Like, tailoring became more relaxed. You know, we see denim and, you know, especially double denim kind of taking over, and flares. I mean, you know, what a time.
What a time. And it's all back now. Really, I mean, did it ever go away? Not according to my wardrobe, but it's really having a moment now. However, what I did want to chat to you about today, and you and I speak a lot about fast fashion and the work that's being done around the world to not only curb the amount of fashion that's being produced and textile waste, but also, I guess, to curb our appetite a little bit on fast fashion. The leaders there are France. They've brought in laws, taxes. They've even banned things like advertising for fast fashion, in particular from influencers. However, with all of the work that they're doing at the moment, Shein, which is quite possibly the largest global online platform who specialise in cheap fast fashion, they have opened their very first physical store, and it just so happens to be in the heart of Paris. So what does that tell you? I mean, is that kind of them sending a message to not only France but to the world that you can give us all the laws you want, you're never going to stop us?
I mean, and we're still living in a time when the market dictates who gets to do what they want. And, you know, Shein is their global annual turnover is $37 billion. They're the fifth largest retailer in France. So, you know, despite, you know, the French, you know, Paris is the fashion capital of the world, and they are very proud of that, and they are very interested in protecting artisans and protecting the quality of clothes. And, you know, really, we've seen them kind of pioneer this legislation to prevent fast fashion and this kind of junk clothing from taking over. But what it really shows us when we see a store opening on the streets of Paris is that the market is still winning. You know, the dollar still speaks. But I do love that the French, you know, they love to protest, and I love that they're out there making it very clear that this isn't the direction that they want, you know, to see their kind of fashion.
Yeah, but there were sort of two hordes of people, weren't there, when the physical store of Shein opened in one of the most, you know, the fanciest shopping meccas in the heart of Paris. You had a lot of protesters, but you also had a lot of people lining up for hours and hours and hours in order to get in there. And you had these two groups side by side. I find that fascinating.
It is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, it really kind of shows you the direction that the world is going. And there's kind of two camps, you know. There's the people out there baking their own bread, and then there's the people out there who are, you know, ordering Uber, McDonald's on Uber Eats. And that is, we're seeing a bigger and bigger divide. People love Shein because it's so cheap and they have such a wide variety of things. And I guess there's an education piece that's perhaps missing. You know, we know that these products have been linked to forced labor, to child labor. We know that there are issues of chemicals on those clothing that can be very harmful to human health. We know that you're probably only wearing those garments once or twice before you're throwing them away. But really, in terms of educating people to come over to the baking the bread side is, you know, is where the protesters need to be focusing their energy.
What does it tell you about the next steps globally? We know that Shein have had pop-up stores around Australia. For this huge store, this is not just a small store that's opened. This is a huge shopfront that they've allowed. I mean, so Paris, it's not like they secretly opened and then all of a sudden, by shock to the local government, that store was there. So even though they've introduced all these new laws, they've also allowed the Shein to have a physical store. Are we now likely to see one in Australia or to see one in the heart of London?
Look, it wouldn't surprise me if London was the next stop. It certainly wouldn't surprise me to see a permanent Shein store opening here. You know, their annual sales in Australia are over $1 billion, which is huge. And we are not regulating fast enough or harshly enough to protect our customers and our market from these kind of products coming in. And, you know, you can see it, the intention of the French laws is to really limit the the exposure of people to those products, and they haven't been successful in this case. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens next, because that Parliament is, they've made it clear that they're going to be aggressive about legislating against fast fashion, and we don't have that political will here. So it's interesting from Shein's perspective, you know, there are so many other places they could have gone to where they wouldn't probably have been met with protests.
And I just wonder whether some of those laws will uphold when it's a physical store and not online, because one of the laws that they brought in was a tax, but it was a tax on what was being sent out. And if that's eliminated, then that's a huge loophole that they've found themselves around.
100%. And I'm sure that that was part of the motivation of opening the store where they opened it. And, you know, I mean, also when one in three French people are shopping on this customers of Shein, like that really speaks for itself. So, you know, we have got our work cut out for us, you know, in terms of really making people understand that they're wasting their money. You're literally buying rubbish. You're buying future landfill when you're purchasing from this company. And that's something that we need to get people to understand.
Luciane, always good to get your thoughts. It'd be interesting to see if this is the first of what may be many physical stores of Shein. Luciane Tonti, sustainable fashion editor and author. I'll speak with you soon. We've been reflecting on what you were wearing in 1975. Do you even remember what you were wearing on the day you heard of the Whitlam dismissal? And so many of you do. I've never loved these texts more. Maddie's in Nathalia. I was wearing jeans, white canvas tennis shoes and a T-shirt. Back then, I always matched my socks with the colour of my T-shirt. I was on the boulevard in Ivanhoe driving my minivan. I pulled the car over to listen to the news. When I returned to work, they were all cheering. I'd never felt so alone in that moment. And this, Rish, I was in grade two. Our school principal banned girls from wearing halter neck tops. The girls rose up and we started a petition. It was the first petition I ever signed. I loved my 70s fashion. That's from Mitch, who's in Oakley. I think I started a petition for the nuns because I got my hair tipped. And we weren't allowed to get our hair tipped. We also weren't allowed to have two earrings, and I had both. I was quite the rebel, and I started a petition that we should be allowed to get our hair coloured. The nuns weren't too impressed. Rish, I was likely wearing my favourite embroidered cheesecloth skirt that my dear mum made, and Staggers flares, maybe some treads as well. These were sandal things, or the good old desert boots. Another, this is from Rosie. I was probably wearing jag denim and a jag top. We just had a long lunch at Greens in Chapel Street, drinking rosé. We went back to work in our VE Beetle when we heard the news of the dismissal on the car radio. The language, the disbelief that followed was quite loud in that car. That's from Rosie in St Kilda. Please keep those outfits coming through if you can remember what you were wearing on the day.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
I'm loving the amount of desert boots that are coming through. I tried to do desert boots. I can't make desert boots quite work, but I do love a good desert boot. Rish, I was 12 in 1975. I would have been wearing jeans, a T-shirt, flannelette shirt and desert boots. I'm pretty much still wearing the exact same outfit 50 years on. That's from David. David, lovely to hear from you. Thank you. You can text through if you have pictures. I'm up for pictures. You can text them through 0437 774 774. We'll also try and get back to more of your calls if either you or your child is autistic, and whether or not you've been able to join a team sport, and what changes need to be made to make sure that everybody feels inclusive. We know we've got some really great calls on that, so we're going to get back to them in just a tick. But before we do, I want to ask you if you know how many different types of bees that we have. Can you name any bees, and in particular, Australian bees? So this week is Australian Pollinators Week. I know, I didn't know either, but we should know more about our native bees. But someone who does is Dr. Kit Pendergrast, who's a native bee scientist with the University of Southern Queensland. Kit, this is an important week. You know, we don't think too much about our pollinators until something goes pear-shaped and they're not pollinating, and then we realise how vital they are. Does the average person even know how many native Australian bees we have?
Sadly not. And I mean, the Australians that do know about our native bees, they know about the common ones, but the ones that really need our attention, the ones that might be specialised on our native flowers, the ones that are at risk of extinction, The research that I published yesterday found that these native bees just aren't getting the attention that they desperately need.
So are they in trouble?
So our native bees are in trouble, but part of the trouble is that there is no funding or investment into monitoring them. So we have over 2,000 species of native bees in Australia. That is 4 times the number of mammal species we have in Australia.
Wow.
So massive amount. And these are estimates. So there's over 1,700 described species of native bees, but we estimate there's 500 undescribed species. Just today, I published a new species of native bee, Megachile lucifer. But until, you know, that publication, it didn't have a name. We didn't even know it existed. So there's these big knowledge gaps. And yeah, the native bees, they are at risk of extinction. Many of them rely on healthy native vegetation. And as we know in Australia, this is being cleared for mining, especially for agriculture, especially livestock agriculture. So this important habitat that our native bees rely on, that's being cleared. Many of our native bees are very specialist. They're fussy. So they might only be able to forage on, say, eucalypt trees. And so if we clear all the eucalypt trees, even if we put in fields and fields of canola, you know, that's lots of flowers there, but they can't forage on them.
So I know yesterday we were talking about the Frog ID app and research in collaboration with citizen scientists to identify one of the many species of frogs and native frogs that we have just in some of our waterways and ponds. Is there something similar that can be done with bees? If people, because more and more of us are trying to plant native gardens, even native nature strips, if we maybe see a little bee or something that we suspect to be a bee and we don't know much about it, what is there something we can do with that information? Can we take a photograph? Can we send it through to somebody?
Yeah, so you can take photographs, and then scientists can ID often to genus level, but it's very hard to ID our native bees to species level from a photograph alone, just because they're very small. So, sorry, that's my baby in the background.
Oh, no, that's just actually made my heart swell. It sounds like you're multitasking like a genius there, Kit. How old?
She's 10 months old. Her name is Sapphire. And, she's just waking up, so she's a little bit grumpy.
Oh, totally get it. Well, let's see how far we can go until you, this is obviously not the most important thing for you to be doing right now.
it's a juggle, but, I'm really keen to educate her about native bees, because that's a big issue, and I think that's why so few Australians know about our native bees. Everyone knows about honeybees. Very few people even know that they're an introduced species. But if we start from the beginning in schools, in daycares, you know, at universities, that, you know, these, we have native bees, and this is how many we have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Euroglossinae, these are a group of little bees that include probably one of the smallest bees in the world, just 2 millimetres long. Like, that's very cool. That occurs in Australia, Euroglossina clypeiris. And then some people say, oh, you know, they're scientific names, they're too hard. But if you've ever spoken to a four-year-old, they can easily say, they know what a Tyrannosaurus rex is. They know what
yeah, that's so true. Just change our priorities on what we teach, and also too on what we plant and what we remove. Kit, we're going to let you get back to your beautiful barb. They're probably getting, if they've just woken up, they're going to be hungry and a little bit grumpy. So
yeah.
Congratulations on the work and the research that you do. It's so important. Dr. Kit Pendergrass is a native bee scientist with the University of Southern Queensland, looking at, I guess, just how bad our awareness and our knowledge of Australian native bee species are. So is it something we should be teaching more so than, you know, as Kit said, about how many dinosaurs we know? Should we be looking at how many different bees we know? I've also been talking about, can you remember what you were wearing on the day you heard of the Whitlam dismissal? This, Rish, as a conservative business college in the city in 1975. That winter, we'd been wearing calf-length corduroy shifts over polo neck jumpers with dark stockings and cork-soled clogs. Senior staff members came into our class and announced with great pomp and ceremony that Whitlam had been sacked. I think she was really happy about it. We've also been talking at the very beginning of the program, so if you missed it, I urge you to jump on the Listen app and go back because really large numbers of people who are autistic, both kids and adults, want to play team sports but really struggle. Jeremy's in Bendigo. Morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. How are you?
Really well. What did you want to share?
I coach for the Bunjil's Basketball Club here in Bendigo, and we have a fair few children who are mentally challenged as such on that sort of spectrum-wise. And I can definitely say as a coach, it is challenging on one level, but when you actually see them developmentally go through on their levels and then progress through, it is definitely rewarding. Like getting them to see those highs and lows all together is one of those good things.
So, and you also, I remember when Rosemary called earlier, it's about talking to the refs, talking even Rosemary's team, where they've got a young boy for the last 6 weeks who is autistic, who's been playing. They even speak to the opposition coach and say, hey, just so you know, if so-and-so wants to come off or if something happens, everyone's on the same page and they understand. So it's about that open dialogue, Jeremy.
It is. We don't do that to affect, I dare say that she has someone who's more up that scale than what we do. We have mild sort of discuss, but we can tell as coaches and obviously parents giving their inputs to us as well. Hey, can you bring him off court? You know, he's starting to have a meltdown, or we can see that, etc. You know, we just bring him off court, you know, as if it's a normal interchange sort of deal, and then we deal with it right there and then, and then continue on and get back on the court. It doesn't last for very long because basically everyone else is playing.
Good on you, Jeremy. I think it's really important. Well done. I just want to quickly squeeze in Sally, who's been waiting patiently. Hi, Sally.
Oh, hi, Rochelle. Thanks for the call.
That's all right. What do
you say? So, Rochelle, I'm the current chair of an organisation called Power Assist, and we run a basketball competition in Melbourne in Kew and Hawthorne. Been going for nearly 40 years. And the organisation was set up because there was a need to have a place where people who had special needs could go and be with their fellow basketballers. So every week for 40 weeks of the year, we have over 150 players who come from all around Melbourne to come and play in an organisation that's just for them.
Can you say what was the name of it was again, Sally?
Power Assist.
Power Assist. Okay, yeah, wonderful. So
lots of kids that come, or people who come, and we don't like say who can or can't play. They usually nearly self-select. If they're comfortable in the environment with people who have different needs, then they're comfortable and they stay. And if they find themselves uncomfortable, they don't.
That's right. And I think that's the thing. It's about just reading the play at the time. But what I've been really encouraged about today is just people taking, I guess, their own little steps to make sure that everybody feels welcome. If you missed that chat, it's at the beginning of the program. I urge you to have a listen, especially if you're involved in a team sport, either as a kid or as an adult. Maybe there are people who aren't involved and you haven't really thought about how you advertise yourself on your website or what your forms look like. So just go to the ABC Listen app, look for Conversation Hour, and you can listen back to the program. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.